part 4 of a 7-part miniseries on the books from the Chronicles of Narnia. I'm William O'Flaherty, one of the co-hosts and the producer of these shows. This podcast comes to you from NarniaCast.com, a place devoted to all things broadcast related to Narnia, and is a featured partner site of the Middle Earth Network. If you want to hear other programs in the series, stop by NarniaCast.com to pick them up. This fourth show is on The Silver Chair, which was the fourth book published when the Narnia Chronicles were initially released. At the time this podcast was recorded, our guest Dr. David Downing was only available by phone, and so while my co-hosts were via Skype, making it possible for everyone to hear each other was somewhat challenging. Hopefully the slight reduced audio quality doesn't prevent you from enjoying the program. First, let me welcome back Dr. Crystal Hurd to the show. Welcome, Crystal.
Glad to be back, William.
Also here to discuss The Silver Chair is Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you for having me again. This is excellent.
Our special guest today is Dr. David Downing. He is the professor of English at Elizabethtown College, and he is the author of several books, and most of them related to C.S. Lewis. I'll just name a couple here. One especially relevant to what we're discussing is an excellent book called Into the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis and the Narnia Chronicles. He's also written Into the Region of Awe, Mysticism in C.S. Lewis, and The Most Reluctant Convert, C.S. Lewis's Journey to Faith. Welcome to our discussion of The Silver Chair, David.
I'm glad to join you all. It'll be an interesting discussion.
Our first segment is the story behind the story. Dr. Downing is going to share in just a moment some background information about The Silver Chair. Here, this will be some background information about the story before we actually get into it, either about the writing process, some interesting information. So those of you who maybe haven't read it, or if you have, this will enrich your reading. So what's some of the background information, kind of the story behind the story for The Silver Chair, David?
Well, as you know, Lewis was writing the Narnia Chronicles fairly rapidly, beginning in the late 40s with The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. He had a bit of a difficulty trying to decide what to do as a sequel after The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and he started with a fragment called the Le Fay fragment, which is reprinted in Walter Hooper's Past Watchful Dragons, and it's interesting that that opens with a Aunt Gertrude, who's a headmistress who bullies the children and later gets promoted to Parliament and bullies the other parliamentarians, and it's an interesting bit of school satire in that fragment, which later shows up in The Silver Chair. He got hung up on that storyline because it began to get too autobiographical, and he set that aside, and that was later used in Magician's Nephew. And so eventually he came up with the idea for Prince Caspian, the idea of what would it feel like if you were called, and so the children are called back to Narnia. And then he decided that he had something good going here, so he was going to do at least a trilogy. So he came up with the idea of The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, based upon the whole mythical idea of the voyage, St. Brendan and the Odyssey and that sort of thing. The Silver Chair came fairly quickly forth in the series. He wrote three of the books in about a year. And so The Silver Chair, I think the motif that struck him the most was the idea of the journey to the underworld. He was fascinated by Dante's Inferno, and he was fascinated by Book 6 of the Aeneid, where Aeneas goes to the underworld to visit his father. So I think the initial creative impulse for the storyline probably came from his fascination with journeys to the underworld. As a matter of fact, when they were playing with titles, he thought about calling it Night Under Narnia or Gnomes Under Narnia or some sort of motif that involved the underland. One of his favorite books was called A Giant Land, which has to do also with an underworld journey. So it's about in the middle of the series, and I think it's primarily his idea was that they were going to go up to the north and eventually go into under subterranean caverns to discover the person they were seeking.
Next up is the short summary with Dr. Crystal Hurd. Be sure to check out her website that has a variety of content, mostly related to C.S. Lewis. Direct your web browser to crystalhurd.com. That's C-R-Y-S-T-A-L HURD.com. Just to be clear, Crystal will be providing a complete summary of the story, so spoiler alert. If you haven't read the entire story, or if you don't want to be reminded of it, then skip ahead about 3.5 minutes.
The Silver Chair begins with a familiar face, Eustace from the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Eustace is a student at the Progressive Experiment House. Eustace is comforting a classmate, Jill Pole, after she was bullied by other students. Eustace tells her of a wonderful place called Narnia and wishes to be transported there. Then Eustace and Jill are chased by some bullies, so they escape into the land behind the gym and find themselves in Narnia. Eustace and Jill get separated when Eustace loses his balance and falls off a cliff after attempting to save Jill. Then Jill meets Aslan. Aslan sends Jill on a quest to recover the lost Prince Rillian, son of Prince Caspian, now King Caspian. Rillian vanished after his mother was killed by a serpent, and Rillian set out to kill it in retaliation. Many years have passed, and Caspian is now an old man. Caspian wishes to locate Rillian so he can inherit the kingdom as its rightful heir. To assist Jill and Eustace on their journey, Aslan gives Jill 4 signs. Then Aslan blows Jill into Narnia, as he has for Eustace. The children meet an elderly Trumkin while the much-aged King Caspian is boarding the ship. Jill then realizes that they have missed their first sign to speak to an old friend. The children are brought into the palace and later attend a parliament of owls with Master Glimfeather. The owls recommend the company of a new companion on their quest, a marsh wiggle named Puddleglum. Although Puddleglum is a consummate pessimist, his knowledge of the land and of the creatures greatly assists Eustace and Jill. On their way, the company meets a beautiful woman, the Lady of the Green Kirtle, who tells them to continue north toward Harfang and the giants to participate in the autumn feast. The travelers are welcome there, but soon discover that they are the main course for the feast. They escape and find an entrance to an underground world marked with another of Aslan's signs. After floating on a lake in the underworld that is ruled by the Lady of the Green Kirtle, the party meets a young man who admits that he suffers from psychotic episodes and must be tied to a silver chair. If he is released, he will return into a green serpent and kill everyone. While captured in this chair, the young man asks to be freed in the name of Aslan. Recognizing the last sign, the group releases the young man, who begins to destroy the chair. He declares his identity, the long-lost Prince Rillian, who has been kept underground by the Lady of the Green Kirtle and Queen of the Underworld. At that moment, she appears and attempts to trick them with a strange fog. She questions their construct of reality, of the existence of the overworld and of Aslan. Puddleglum extinguishes the fire in the fireplace, stopping the strange fog. He then defends the existence of Aslan and of the overworld using the same logic and rhetorical techniques as the queen. Suddenly, the queen morphs into a large serpent and attempts to squeeze Rillian until Eustace, Puddleglum, and Rillian strike and kill the serpent. The party heads out of the underworld, and the gnomes who live there, formerly slaves of the queen, are now free. Rillian returns home as Caspian is passing away. Caspian's body is laid in the stream, then Aslan's blood revives the old king and returns him to youth. Aslan returns the children back to their world. He roars, which makes the wall of Experiment House collapse. The tyrannical headmistress of Experiment House calls the police, who do not believe her outrageous story that a lion was on school grounds. The headmistress is eventually promoted to Parliament. Circumstances at Experiment House greatly improve, and Eustace and Jill remain good friends after their adventure.
Now it's time for our favorite character segment. Again, we are talking about, of course, the Silver Chair. Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com is going to lead us in that, as before. Paul, as you've done before, go ahead and share some interesting information for those who maybe haven't yet visited NarniaFans.com.
All right, well, NarniaFans.com is a place for all Narnia fans to come together to learn all about the movies, the music behind Narnia, inspired by Narnia, as well as dive a little deeper into the world of C.S. Lewis and his writing. And I guess we'll go right into the favorite characters. Dr. David, tell us a bit about who your favorite characters are, maybe a couple of them, and why they are your favorite characters.
Well, I'm glad I got asked this question first, because I feel like I get to steal the obvious one, who is Puddleglum. Lewis, when he was asked about his favorite characters by Hooper, he said that Reepa Cheep in Voyage of the Dawn Treader and Puddleglum in Silver Chair were his two favorite characters. And so I certainly can see why those two would stand out in his mind. Puddleglum's especially, he's unusual. He's the only character in the Narnia Chronicles who's based on someone that Lewis knew directly. Fred Paxford, their gardener there in Oxford, had a similar characteristic, very solid character, a hard worker, but always took a pessimistic view of things. The first time Lewis and his new wife, Joy, decided to ride on an airplane, Paxford came running out just before they left for the airport and told Lewis, "I don't know if you saw this article, there was a terrible airplane crash in Greece. Everyone on board was burned beyond recognition." And then he repeated that, "burned beyond recognition." So Puddleglum's a great character because he's based partly upon someone who Lewis loved personally. The name is also good. Lewis found the name when writing his history of the 16th century. He found a minor poet named John Studley who was not very good with his word choices. And in describing the river Styx, he called it a puddle glum. And Lewis thought that was a very funny description of this fiery river of the Inferno. And so both the name and the character come from something that already Lewis found amusing before he started writing Silver Chair. So that's a pretty easy choice for me to call a favorite character.
And then we'll move on to Dr. Crystal Hurd.
Well, I'm going to probably have to echo Dr. Downing here, and Alex Puddleglum is my favorite, too. He's just such a great character from the get-go, and I think we all probably know somebody who is a little pessimistic, who's always sort of, I think they call them Debbie Downers or something, the people who are always negative. I especially like the fact that the other Marsh Wiggles think he's too optimistic. They say he needs to sober down a bit. Life isn't all fricasseed frogs and eel pie, so it's a pretty funny thing. It just also shows Lewis's great talent with his humor in his writing.
Excellent. And William?
Well, let's see. I'm going to have to go with the obvious here, and that is Puddleglum that everyone so far has shared. I do, you know, later, though, like in terms of the character development for Eustace, but Puddleglum just, you know, stands out. There's, of course, a chapter devoted to Puddleglum to introduce him. It's a very interesting way that he is introduced, and Crystal was just noting about his perception of himself as well as what he says others say about him. And it's an interesting person. In fact, when we get into the discussion part, I believe we will have a time for a question related to him, noting that, you know, despite his pessimism, he's probably one that you do want around. Even though he can be tend to be negative, he's very realistic and he's going to, you know, stick with what he believes in. Even if he might look on the more negative side. But Puddleglum just is, seems to be a fairly colorful character, even if it's maybe all in shades of gray, so to speak.
I think I would like to throw in an honorable mention, which would be less talked about, which is Glimfeather. Just as I was reviewing the Silver Chair, he's quite a charming character, the big owl that they meet early in the story. The way, when you read it aloud especially, I don't know if you've heard those, the great audio recordings that they did, HarperCollins. I think Jeremy Northrop does the Silver Chair, and he really gets a lot of mileage out of the owlish speech when they say, "I saw you, you flew." And that whole crew of witches, all the way through his speech, he's constantly getting that owlish howl into his conversation. His name, Glimfeather, as I was reading, when he's carrying Jill on his back, they looks down in the moonlight, and it says you can see his feathers glimmering in the moonlight, and I suddenly realized where that character got his name. So I would put him as honorable mention for an interesting character in Silver Chair.
And I suppose you'll want me to tell my favorite characters too, I shouldn't wonder. well, I'll have to, for me, I'd have to say I'm kind of not a pessimistic person at all, so I didn't really find much to relate to in Puddleglum in my readings, so I'm going to take a totally different route and say Eustace and Jill were my favorite characters, not only because I related to them as being like human, but also because I liked the character development that Eustace went through and how he kind of his story reminded me of Paul when he changed, when his name was changed from Saul to Paul after he's seen, like, after he sees Christ. And how he like, Jill calls him Scrub most of the time, and eventually can call him Eustace. And then when Jill is told a list of things to look for by Aslan, like her, I have a hard time remembering things like lists like that. So I found that very relatable, very easy to relate to. And I just, I loved to watch the journey of Jill and Eustace as Eustace goes into a world that he recognizes but has more growing to do, and just goes on a basically a brand new adventure through parts of Narnia that we've never seen before, and has to use his wiles to get out of things and almost return to a bit of the his nature from prior to his big change in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, like his mischievous nature in a way that he kind of went away from when his mother said that he was kind of boring after he returned from Narnia from with the Pevensies at the end of the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And it just made for a fun adventure for me. So those are my two favorite characters.
I like one thing I really like about Eustace in this one is I think you kind of get a glimpse at the old Eustace when they first go in the Sailing of the King, and they're trying to tell a very old Trumpkin what their names are. And he goes, "Useless?" Remember, he's like, "Useless, of course. Why are they even here?" You know, it's a pretty funny joke, you know, he throws in there with the names, with the parallel the names.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
It is interesting that Lewis seemed to really believe in the power of redemption, because we had seen Edward in The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe be such a betrayer of his siblings. It's the first time you read the voice of the Dawn Treader, you're not sure if he's going to be very solid of a leader or not. But we can really see that Edward has been totally transformed. And this time it's Eustace who's the problem child and the brat and the person with a sense of entitlement. And it is interesting that when we get to this story, we're not sure if Eustace is going to have a relapse. But when he tells the owls, "I'm the king's man," we can tell that he's going to be a steady moral character. Lewis really believes in the power of redemption, that when people have been touched in this way, they really are going to be a different person than they had been.
All right, it's time now for the segment called Unique to This Story. With the Silver Chair, we're going to hear from Dr. Downing to find out what elements are maybe only seen in this story, whether it be a character or setting that's maybe not obvious. I don't think he's going to obviously note that Puddle Glum is not mentioned except for a brief mention in one of the later stories, briefly, that he's only in this story. But let's find out from David what other aspects are unique. But let me remind the listener here that one of Dr. Downing's books is Into the Wardrobe, C.S. Lewis and the Narnian Chronicles. And then if they want to sample some things online, David first mentioned where they can go to get some things.
Well, a good place to look would be cslewis.com, which is sponsored by HarperCollins. They also have a Facebook page, and they feature various bloggers on C.S. Lewis. There's 15 or 20 good bloggers at cslewis.com, and interested readers can find 12 or 15 different entries by me at cslewis.com, including one upon Lewis's fascination with Virgil's Aeneid and how that comes into the Silver Chair. Some of the unique features of the Silver Chair, I think the main thing for me is the long journey to the underworld. And once again, I was fascinated when they just had Lewis's translation of the Aeneid come out in 2011, because Lewis translated this whole section where Aeneas goes down into the underworld, and there's actually a section where it says it's very easy to go down to the underworld, but it's very hard to get back out. and that reminds me of this repeated refrain throughout. It's easy to fall into the sunlit lands, but it's hard to get back to the sunlit lands when you fall to the underworld. They also cross a great river. They meet these great ghostly multitudes of sad people, and then they see a river of fire. So I think this whole journey to the underworld motif is unique to the Silver Chair. Another unique feature of the Silver Chair, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe this is the only time we actually visit Aslan's country. When Eustace and Jill first arrive there, we see something of Aslan and the stream and the calmness there. And then again at the end of the story, when Prince Caspian is brought back to life, I think those are the only times we get to glimpse not only the underworld, but also the overworld of actually not just seeing Aslan's country in distance, but actually being there.
Actually, if I might comment, we do visit Aslan's country once more with the last battle. So,
oh, true. Well, I would have to say the only time we see it sort of in this world before you go to the whole apocalypse and the new heaven and the new earth, yes, that would be an important qualification, because certainly we see Aslan's country much more fully in the last battle. That's true, sure.
Now it's time for the longest segment in this show, and that is a general discussion regarding the Silver Chair. Here we're going to tackle, at least 5, maybe up to 7 questions related to the Silver Chair. We haven't said it already, but with this podcast, we are not in any way attempting to exhaustively examine the Silver Chair. And so even in this, especially in this discussion segment, we don't hope to cover all the interesting aspects that could be covered, but enough to hopefully enrich your previous reading of it, or to encourage you to go back and read it again, or read it for the first time if you have yet to read it. Kicking off will be a question that we're going to let Crystal answer first, and that is, Lewis provides some interesting commentary on the educational system in Silver Chair, using Experiment House as an example. What are Lewis's thoughts on the state of public education, and do you believe they resonate with the current American educational system?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. Lewis actually had quite a bit to say about the education system. One, because he was an Oxford Don himself, and that was his career, was working in education. But as many people know, he published frequently on commentary. Abolition of Man comes to mind first. But he also had a small essay called Democratic Education, where he discusses the temperament of the common classroom in Britain during that time. And so he had quite a bit to say. I think it's incredibly interesting that he calls it Experiment House, and also that he goes out of his way to tell you that the teaching strategies are ineffective and that the children are very unhappy under the Experiment House. And he actually makes some comments about the head, which he capitalizes, but mentions as a woman headmaster, basically, is not running it very well. So there's poor leadership in the schools, which is causing the students to be unsuccessful academically. I personally think that it resonates quite a bit, being a teacher myself, and with the current state of the education system. There's a lot of new programs with snazzy acronyms, and they're always trying to fix and improve. And so I feel sometimes that we experiment quite a bit with the instructional system, in our country, because we are sort of trying to find things that fit. And sometimes I feel like the headmaster there, he's like, there's chaos and not any lions roaring or anything, but it's a very interesting commentary that Lewis provides, I think, and gives, I think, which he's great at, gives us like a lasting wisdom about the things that resonate still with us today.
Well, I definitely would agree. Generally, anything that he thought of as progressive, he was not in favor of. At one point, he wanted to, in his letters, he says he would like to start something called the Society for the Prevention of Progress. And obviously the educational methods in Experiment House are supposed to be very progressive. And it mentions that they don't have Bibles and they don't teach her how to curtsy. And so none of the old learning seems but I think he probably would have been even less impressed by American educational system. In one letter, someone described to him the idea in America of being educated not by taking comprehensive exams, but by accumulating credits. And if you take a class and pass it, you get credits, and after 4 years. And when they described that to him, he said, "That sounds to me like a horse show where you don't judge the horses by their strength or their speed, but rather by how many oats you've tried to feed them." I think that pretty much betrays his attitude toward that approach to schooling, that you simply try to throw a lot of information at students and hope they absorb as much as possible.
Paul, did you have anything on this one?
I just wanted to quickly point out that it kind of says a lot about what Lewis thought, that the headmistress that kind of fails at Experiment House is eventually elected to Parliament. I don't know if that's a statement on how well she can lead and manage, or and then the state of Parliament at the time, but I think it's a little bit of a funny little joke.
Our next question deals with the aspect of the supposal, in terms of people often talk about Aslan as a supposal representing Christ, specifically because of, you know, especially in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the sacrificial scene. But let's explore the way in which Lewis draws more heavily, actually, on Old Testament imagery and the scene in portraying Aslan in the Silver Chair.
Yes, I think when I read some Lewis critics or commentators, they often talk about Aslan almost specifically as a Christ figure. And I think that leaves out the complexity of Aslan as we see him portrayed through all seven of the books. What strikes me about the Silver Chair is how many strong Old Testament allusions we get. When she lands in Aslan's country and says, "Are you somebody?" he simply says, "I am." And we certainly can't miss the resonance there of Moses at the burning bush meeting God who identifies himself as I am. And then when he gives her the four signs and says, "You need to remember these, say them every morning, say them in the evening," that's almost not quite a translation, but certainly a paraphrase of several passages in the Pentateuch, especially in Deuteronomy, when it talks about the importance of the law. So I feel like there's an echo of Mount Sinai, that she's receiving the commandments that she will need in order to fulfill her mission when she goes to Narnia, and it's very important to remember them. One of Lewis's favorite books of the Old Testament was the Psalms, and they constantly stress remembering the law and loving the law and the importance of the law. So I think that ultimately the law is inadequate because she can't follow the signs and she makes a bunch of mistakes, and Aslan needs to be there to help her on her journey. But I'm fascinated by how many of the allusions in the early chapters of the book come from Mount Sinai, Moses, the giving of the law. Even some of the phrases that he uses remind you of the Psalms when he says, "I shall not always be scolding." At the end, when he agrees to go scare the children in Experiment House, he says, "They shall only see my back," which reminds you again of the Old Testament, where God tells Elijah that I will pass by and you will see me from behind. So I think it's interesting that he wants you to see all of the persons of the Trinity in various echoes throughout the different Narnia Chronicles.
Next, then, our third question we want to examine is related to the four signs that were just mentioned a moment ago. Jill is obviously the one given the task of remembering these four signs. While we could discuss some other aspects, I want to first try to focus on the aspect of what happens to Jill when she finds Eustace and she gets so distracted about what she sees, and she doesn't immediately tell him the signs. And then when she does, she has difficulty remembering them, or just allows herself to be kind of hushed and doesn't tell them until not way later, but much later than she should have, and just how this is a tendency to, within our own life. Since I didn't form that as a question here, let me be the first to comment on that. And that is, even if you don't consider the Christian aspects of it in terms of remembering four signs and remembering scripture, when you're, if there's some important, points or tasks or anything that is helpful in your own personal life to remember, if you don't keep them in the forefront of your mind, then it's going to be so easy to be distracted. by other things and kind of keep you off your goal. For Jill here, she was the one, you know, picked to remember the four signs. But then when she goes, even though Aslan warned her that, you know, when you're down in the valley, so to speak, instead of up in the mountaintops, then things are going to look a little bit different. It's going to be hard. She is given the, she was told to, you know, repeat them before. She was kind of had a lazy attitude about it. Yeah, I remember. But then when she goes to actually tell, she doesn't. And so while we can also talk about like later in terms of not remembering them, I just wanted to note here or underscore the fact that when she's given the task and then she's supposed to tell him, she gets so distracted, and it's so easy in our own lives to let other things distract us. Or even when we start to do something, like when Jill is starting to tell Eustace in the story, Eustace doesn't know how important it is. And so he kind of shuts her up because he doesn't know how important it is. But then Jill just keeps quiet when she shouldn't have. Of course, things work out with the other factors and whatnot. But I found that interesting aspect to underscore. I don't know if others of you have anything to add related to that or other aspects of the signs.
Well, I was mentioning earlier the analogy with Mount Sinai and the receiving of the Ten Commandments. And with Ten Commandments, here is this miracle of the commandments given on tablets of stone. But as soon as he gets down the mountain, here they are making a golden calf and worshiping other gods, and he throws down the tablets. So how quickly that literal mountaintop experience gets shattered by the reality of living in the world. And Aslan actually predicts this to Jill. He actually says, this is all very clear to you in the clear mountain air of my country, but when you descend into Narnia, you need to remember things are going to be very confusing, and you're going to need to remember them and use discernment. And so he actually, Aslan anticipated this was going to happen, but in the real world, sometimes the moral principles that seem very clear to us, when we actually get in a situation, we have to exercise discernment and make a real effort to not get off task, as it were.
Well, next up, I alluded to it earlier, and that is it's going to deal with Puddleglum. Obviously, we have noted about our favorite characters, and most have picked him. He steals the show in many ways with his numerous funny lines that, for him, aren't intended to be funny, but of course, Lewis, writing it, he knew how it would come across. But despite his gloomy-sounding name, by his own admission, as Crystal had noted earlier, he's one of the more optimistic Marsh Wiggles. He does tend to have a more negative perspective, though, but when you see of everything that he does in the story, you kind of see it's not so bad to maybe have someone that is not afraid, so to speak, to look at the negative. Now, of course, there's the extremes and whatnot, but I guess the actual question is, do we sometimes need a friend who is as cautious as him? And if so, or if not, why? I'll take the first shot since I created the question. That is, I think that we definitely do. Now, one of the things that I kind of recognized here in the story is, you know, we're not saying that, okay, everyone should be like Puddleglum, but we need a variety of people around us to help us. I'm reminded of a different story that involved like four different friends and different personalities, the kid story I used when I was a guidance counselor. And here in this story, Jill obviously has a different personality than Eustace and Puddleglum as well. And so it takes a team effort. And so oftentimes it's good to have on our team someone who is more cautious. And so that's why I wanted to underscore about this.
Yeah, I think he brings a really unique perspective to the story. He's, I think, the most pessimistic, honestly, in all of the stories, obviously. But I think what I love about Puddleglum is at the very end, when they're with the Green Witch and she's, you know, discussing, you know, that the sun is just a lamp and Aslan's just a cat. He's the one that comes through and says, well, if my world is false, Narnia licks your world every time. You know, and he is the one who's sort of grounded and really stands up to the Green Witch and helps the whole group collaboratively defeat her. So that's another reason why I really love Puddleglum is even though we sort of see him, you know, as a glass half empty character, through many minutes of the story, he, to me, becomes emerges as the hero in that last scene as standing up to the Green Witch.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. It was his statement to the Green Witch that basically said everything. Like, he actually seemed to be the one that, I guess the one Marshwiggle that may be like a breath of fresh air for all of, I guess, the Marshwiggles that are out there, in a way where he could be the first of a change that now he's seen as dark as people can, or as dark as we can get, as people can get and stuff, and seeing that there is a brighter side to things, and can take that and almost become a apostle or like a missionary to his own people, for kind of a more, while still pessimistic, but kind of a more optimistic view for a Marshwiggle to have.
I think it's interesting that the way Lewis writes, the way he structures his stories, a lot of quest narratives, there's an individual hero who does everything. Even Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, he's the one who has to go up and face the Green Knight. And a lot of the classical myths, there's one hero, Perseus, who's going to go out and achieve his quest. Lewis almost always sends an ensemble of characters on a quest, or actually a team. What I think of Total Glum is when I'm doing committee work and everybody's all excited about, let's have this new classical studies minor and it's going to be great, and we're going to do Greek and we're going to do Latin. And somebody always says, well, now, wait a minute. How much student demand is there for this? Where do we have the financing? What's the administration going to think? And they start asking all these questions. And at first it's kind of annoying, but then after a while you're realizing that they're injecting a note of realism into the discussion. And Puddle Glum is very good about that. At one point they say, first we'll go find this. And he says, oh, not allowed to go looking for it. They just assume, of course, they're going to find Prince Rillian after all these other great heroes have failed. And so I think he's a very valuable member of the team. By being the pessimist, he's the realist. That sort of gives he tempers some of the shallow optimism of the other characters about fulfilling their quest.
Finally, then, let's take a look at the apologetics aspect that the Silver Chair deals with, and that is, you know, Lewis is obviously known for his significant contributions to that field, the rational or pragmatic defense of the Christian faith. Then you're also aware that he served as president of the Oxford Socratic Club, which encouraged open discussions on various aspects of the faith. Now, in the Silver Chair specifically, the Green Witch challenges the notions of, you know, oh, is there really a sun? Is there really a Aslan? And things of that nature. Stating that, you know, they could just simply be fabrications of existing things. Puddle Glum defends the existence of Narnia and Aslan using the same rhetorical strategy or defense as the Green Witch. Is this Lewis's way of introducing an apologetic mindset or effective technique of argumentation to younger readers?
Oh, I definitely think this is Lewis trying to sneak some apologetics into students' minds. He talked about in a letter about wanting to teach children about Christianity by sneaking past the watchful dragons of boring Sunday school lessons and stained glass windows. People forget that he took a first in philosophy as an undergraduate, and then he tutored in philosophy for a year before he became an English professor. So he was quite well-versed in classical philosophy, especially. I believe that her argument that the sun is simply a projection of the lamps that we have down here in Underworld, and you see a kitty and you think of what the great cat being Aslan, I'm pretty sure that she is a parody of Freud's doctrine of projection. Freud said we all would like to live in a world where there's no sickness and death, and so we imagine heaven. We would like to have a perfect father. We all have imperfect fathers. And he had a very specific idea that religion was a projection of something which is inadequate in our world. We see it in some transcendent world being perfect. And I believe that Lewis is using the Green Witch as a parody of this Freudian idea of projection, which he also talks about in Pilgrim's Regress. He critiques Freudianism. In terms of Puddle Glum's reply, he actually mentioned in a letter that Puddle Glum is summoning something called Pascal's Wager. The Christian philosopher Pascal said, if I believe that Christianity is true, there is a benign God who's leading human history, who's leading my life. That gives me hope, that gives me optimism, that gives me a feeling of meaning and purpose. If I die and there's nothing, I've lost nothing, but if I die and it was all true, then I lived my whole life in accordance with what God's will was. And so Lewis said in a letter that he was taking Poteguan's simple response, and he was rephrasing the famous argument by the Christian philosopher Pascal about, if we believe it, life is that much better, but if it turns out to be false, we'll never know it because we will not survive this life and we won't realize that we were mistaken.
And Dr. Downing is right. I believe that Lewis is sneaking past the watchful dragons, some a crumb of apologetics. And it's very interesting how he, I mean, it really honestly sounds like a discussion between a philosophy between two intellectuals. I mean, you know, the fact that you question everything, and then the fact that Puddleglum uses that same techniques, those same logic, you know, to disprove her, or to say, well, fine, then if it's a game and we're all babies making up a game, then, you know, what a terrible thing, you know, but I'm still going to believe in Aslan, and I'm still going to, you know, believe in my ideals because they're way better than yours. So it's a very interesting take. Again, and like we mentioned in the question, Lewis was known as an avid argumentor, I guess. He actually seen one of his students speak, and he was discussing how much of a lively debater Lewis was. It's very interesting that he weaves these philosophical arguments into his narrative. And I think he does an excellent job at it. And as if I were a child reading this, which I didn't read it till I was much older, but if I were a child reading this, it would put me in that mindset, you know. Well, people are going to say negative things about what you believe, but here's how you can counter that, and then here's how you can have a defense. So it's honestly my favorite part in the book is that section right there where Puddleglum stands up to her, and then they soon defeat her after they stand up to her. It's a great piece of work, especially in the Narnian Chronicles. I think it's one of the best, definitely, examples of apologetics that he's written. So, I think it's cool that he weaved it in for kids.
Well, there are many other aspects we could discuss about the Silver Chair. We're going to let Crystal have the last word. But maybe we could revisit this or any other Narnia story in the future. If you have questions you would like us to address about the Silver Chair, feel free to give it to us by leaving it in the comment section online at narniacast.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, the creator of EssentialCSLewis.com, a site dedicated to a variety of information about Lewis and not just focused on the Narnia stories. Again, that's EssentialCSLewis.com. And now let me thank the individuals co-hosting with me. Thanks first goes to Dr. Crystal Hurd, whose web presence can be found at crystalhurd.com.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, William.
Then, of course, Paul Martin from NarniaFans.com has been helping us explore the Silver Chair today. We appreciate your contribution, Paul.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
Finally, Dr. David Downing has been our special guest expert. Dr. Downing is the professor of English at Elizabethtown College and is the author of many books on C.S. Lewis. Be sure to check the show notes for links to them. Thank you, David, for joining us.
Well, thank you, William. I never want to pass up an opportunity to talk about the Narnia Chronicles.